Well, that all took longer than necessary. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams. It's Monday, December the 28th. Good to have you with us. After several days of delay and a lot of back and forth, President Trump signed the $900 billion COVID-19 relief package. But the president's delay has caused a lot of confusion about how some of the elements of that relief package will be distributed. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is here to help explain. Hey, Mitchell.
Hi, Kimberly. Good to be here.
So, Mitchell, by signing this on Sunday, the president let a couple of federal pandemic unemployment benefit programs expire briefly. Why is this one-day gap such a big deal?
Well, jobless benefits are paid on a weekly basis, and when President Trump signed the relief bill yesterday, this week had already begun. So it looked like none of the benefits could be given for the week when the bill actually became law, and people were thinking that meant 20 million people would go without the federal jobless benefit extension and the benefit for gig workers and the $300 a week top-up. Ernie Tedeschi, an economist at Evercore ISI, told me that could have meant $9 or $10 billion in lost relief just for this one week.
Could have meant $10 billion. So what actually happened?
Well, the rumor mill was chilling, was churning, that is to say, you know, many, maybe some of the states could figure out workarounds. Then this afternoon, the New Jersey Labor Department tweeted that no one in the two federal pandemic programs will lose a week of benefits after all because of guidance it got from the Federal Labor Department, and the Federal Labor Department didn't answer our calls. Michelle Evermore at the National Employment Law Project says she's starting to see this today from other states as well.
Very quickly, before I let you go, Mitchell, what does that mean for this week?
Well, for this week, it looks like people will be able to simply ask for the benefit that they've been getting that technically did expire. And in addition, they should be starting to get the $300 a week benefit that everyone on unemployment is getting. It may take a couple weeks. We know the state systems aren't great at getting these benefits out, especially when they change. But everyone eventually should get back pay that they're entitled to.
Thanks, Mitchell. And buried in that economic relief package is also an effort to address climate change. It's a plan to phase out a type of refrigerant that's in many home and industrial air conditioners. These chemicals are known as HFCs, and by some measures, they trap far more heat in the atmosphere than CO2. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports on how this ended up in the big economic package.
Whenever a polluting product gets phased out, a cleaner one has to be sold by somebody. So now the refrigeration and air conditioning industry smells opportunity. This U.S. policy syncs up with a global effort to move away from coolants known as hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs.
It creates a global market for alternative appliances.
Andrew Light is a senior fellow at the World Resources Institute, a research group.
The global market for refrigeration and air conditioning units is going to grow like 4.5 times. In the coming decades.
That is, if countries like China and India join the phase-out. They haven't yet ratified an international agreement on this, and neither has the U.S. The incoming Biden administration wants to change that, as does the trade group, the Air Conditioning, Heating, and Refrigeration Institute. Here's the Institute's Samantha Slater.
Perhaps as the United States makes a move to do that, there are over 100 other countries who have already ratified, so we feel perhaps we're a little bit behind, and that will spur on some of the other major countries as well.
This measure hits two sweet spots, the environment and jobs. Though Ben Lieberman at the Competitive Enterprise Institute finds it too good to be true. He says earth-friendly coolants and AC units cost more.
The losers in all of this will be homeowners, car owners, as well as business owners like restaurants and supermarkets and convenience stores that have a lot of refrigeration equipment.
The transition to new cooling units would occur over nearly 3 decades. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders seem to like that the relief package was finally getting done. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our lives have been flipped upside down this year, and so much has changed that it can be hard to keep up with it all. So for a few minutes, we're going to look at what the past year has meant for women in this economy. We got a hold of Chibeli Carazana. She covers the economy for the 19th News. Chibeli, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
How are women doing in this economy at the beginning of this year, pre-pandemic, in the before times?
Well, if we can pause and think back to the before times, which feel like several eons away from us, right before this pandemic started in December of 2019, women surpassed men as the majority of the labor force for only the second time in history. The only other time it had happened was during the Great Recession, when so many men lost their jobs that women actually surpassed them. And so we had reached a point right before all of this started where that had happened again, and it had happened naturally through so much growth that was taking place for women in the labor force, where they got to that 50.04%, just edging out men.
And then what happened?
Well, then what happened was the start of this country's first female recession. And what that meant was that the jobs that really went away this year, the vast majority, were jobs that were held by women. And that was unusual. That had never happened. But this year, we're looking at retail, hospitality, the care fields. Those were the jobs that went away. And so that in about 3 months, what we lost were about 11 million jobs held by women in this economy. And so it started what we have when are still enduring to this day is this recession that has hit women so much harder than men. And there has been an enduring piece of this, which is the second part of it, is this childcare crisis that we are also living in.
I want to come back to the child care crisis in a moment, but a lot of your writing has highlighted the fact that in this first ever She session, it's hitting women of color particularly hard. Can you talk about what that trend has looked like?
Yeah, that has been, you know, one of the saddest parts of this entire experience. If we look at unemployment, for example, it's just one measure, but unemployment for women peaked around like 15.5%. But for Latinas, it hit 20.2%. For Black women, it hit 16.5%. So much of that goes back to this occupational segregation that we talk about sometimes, where it's what are the fields that these folks are pushed into? And ultimately, those fields are a lot of caregiving fields, nursing, healthcare. I mean, we wrote a story recently about the first people who to get vaccines across the country. We looked at every single state. And in the vast majority, two-thirds, you were looking at a woman. And in most cases, you were looking at a woman of color. And so that, I think, spoke eons about these are the people who are most at risk.
Can you talk about just this astronomical number of women leaving the workforce?
Yeah, I think the shocking number came to us in September when 865,000 women left the labor force. And it was just so clear what had happened. You know, school was back, and school was back virtually. And so you had all of these women who were at home and looking at a new school year, they were just making a decision. And it was a difficult decision for a lot of women who said, I'm just going to quit my job and care for my kids because there's no safety net for me right now. And so that's what we've seen over and over is women who are making the decision to leave their jobs, to leave the labor force because all of these other safety nets were not there for them.
How long do you think it's going to take women to gain back these jobs and the wages that they lost?
Yeah, so much of that is going to depend on what the recovery looks like, where we put our focus. I mean, it could take years. I mean, I've seen all kinds of estimates depending on if we do X, Y, or Z. But we know, for example, earlier in the year, there was a study that was done on the gender pay gap. And it found that the gender pay gap may not get back to where it was prior to the pandemic for another decade. We have widened that so much because you have women leaving and then taking so long to get back in the labor force that causes them to have a harder time coming back in at the same pay. This is going to have long lasting consequences for all of those women who in December 2019 had reached a milestone.
Chibeli Carazana is a reporter covering economic issues for the 19th News. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A quick note here, as we think about how much the job market has changed this year, we're looking for stories behind the headline numbers Chibelle and I were just talking about. So send us your story at marketplace.org. Lots of people coming back from a holiday break today, and businesses are tallying receipts. MasterCard estimates U.S. retail sales jumped by 3% this holiday season, more than forecast, and much higher than in the holiday season of 2008 in the thick of the last recession, when sales fell by more than 2%. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra explains what's different this time around.
Steve Sadov is a senior advisor to MasterCard. But back in December 2008, he was CEO of the department store chain Saks. It had been a terrible fall, starting in September.
You had the Lehman bankruptcy, then the market crashed, and you had, in one fell swoop, a 25% decrease at Saks, for example, in our consumption.
As the holidays approached, retailers were sitting on a ton of inventory that they needed to sell, so they offered deep discounts. That cut into their sales numbers for the season. This time around, the recession hit in the spring, so retailers had time to plan, and they took a different approach to the holidays. They stocked fewer items.
So that inventories coming into this holiday season were very lean.
But they held the line on discounts, which, if you're a retailer, is a way to protect your sales numbers. Sure, you won't be selling as many t-shirts, but you'll sell them at a higher price. Craig Rowley at Korn Ferry says another thing that's different is the last recession in 2008 hit more broadly.
It impacted people at every level of economic scale. This recession was driven by the decision to close the economy. It's hit service people who work in restaurants, hotels, hospitality, retail, harder than everyone else.
But he says many Americans still have disposable income, and they're spending it. We've seen that reflected in the government's retail sales numbers, which in November, despite the pandemic, were 4% higher than the year before. I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Our colleagues over at the Marketplace Morning Report had even more coverage of the new economic relief package. It's in our podcast feed from this morning, and tune in tomorrow morning for the latest developments. Coming up,
I've just had to say, like, 2020. It's been 2020. That's what 2020's been doing.
That about sums it up. But first, let's do the numbers. Record highs to start the last week of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 204.6% to close at 30,403. The Nasdaq added 94.7% to finish at 12,899. And the S&P 500 rose 32.8% to end at 3735. We heard from Mitchell and Scott about certain elements of the pandemic relief bill, now law. Here's some other stuff that's in there by the numbers. $82 billion in aid for K-12 schools and colleges, $10 billion for child care assistance, and a 15% boost in SNAP benefits, or food stamps, for 6 months, but no expanded eligibility. But there is a tax break for corporate meal expenses. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Like Scott mentioned earlier, there are lots of small changes we can do to help reduce global warming. But if we could revolutionize one single thing that would have a huge impact, that one thing would be energy, including transitioning to renewable energy, decentralizing power off the grid, modernizing buildings for more efficient power use, and figuring out the financial tools behind a needed and massive shift in how we get and use energy. Over at Marketplace Tech, Molly Wood has been covering the business and technology of adapting to climate change, and she has a story about a startup trying to address all of this at once.
On a rainy day this fall in Brooklyn, a crew was preparing to install an electric heat pump at the parsonage for Cornerstone Baptist Church.
Old school conduit, black pipe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's wow. What they used to use back in the day, black pipe.
The building is nearly a century old. It's brick, four stories tall, with a big turret in one corner, and it relies on oil for heat.
It takes a lot just to get everything heated, and then once you get everything heated, you have to turn on some air just to balance out the heat.
That's Pastor Lawrence Aker. He's lived in the parsonage with his family for 20 years. And you heard him right, by the way. They have to turn on the air conditioning in the dead of winter because the oil heat makes the house too warm. And you want to know how big the pastor's utility bills are?
Enormous. I think just the oil bill, I think it's about $30,000 a year.
$30,000 a year.
So that's this oil. So that's why you can see why we're excited about this opportunity.
The opportunity he's talking about is by way of a startup called Block Power. It's created software that identifies buildings that are good candidates for retrofitting, either with more efficient electric heat, decentralized grids, or renewable energy. Donnell Baird is the founder of Block Power. He says retrofitting buildings like this one is a way to build cities that are more resilient to climate change.
Instead of investing $1 billion in fossil fuel infrastructure, which is expensive and not resilient, we're investing in distributed solar battery electrification projects. If one part of the grid goes down, the rest of the grid can still stay up across Brooklyn.
The company has worked on more than 850 buildings in Brooklyn alone and operates in Oakland, California, and Milwaukee with plans to keep expanding. Baird himself grew up in Brooklyn in a family without much money. When he was growing up, they'd actually turn on the oven to heat their apartment. He said he understands the need and the money it'll take to make these changes.
For a 10-unit apartment building in the Bronx, it may cost $500,000 to replace all of their fossil fuel heating and cooling and hot water with 100% renewable energy powered energy systems.
That, said Baird, is where the investors come in.
They don't have that $500,000 laying around, so we finance it. We identify and train a local mom and pop construction company. We get them trained by the manufacturer of the equipment, and we project manage the installation of the equipment that we finance.
The equipment is leased to the building owner, and Block Power gets paid as part of the lease payments. But the business behind the business is financial tools.
So we think that there is an opportunity to develop a new asset class.
Banks invest in Block Power's projects. The returns aren't huge, and they take a long time to realize, but they are a green investment. And, says Baird, they're reliable. It's
a structured financial product that allows investment banks and pension funds to invest in distributed clean energy technology across America, across the world, and create a new asset class that provides them, 5 to 15% rates of returns, depending on what kind of investments they make.
He said it's kind of like a green infrastructure bond.
If you're talking about introducing environmentally sustainable technologies to the real estate sector, it's a different kind of instrument, but it could be really huge.
Block Power is working with Goldman Sachs and its Urban Investment Group, investment banks, and New York State government's Green Bank. Increasingly, banks and financial institutions recognize the risks of not dealing with climate change and the opportunity for new financial tools and types of investment. In fact, the head of one major equity firm said earlier this year that green investments would become a, quote, mega trend in equity markets. And even despite the pandemic, sustainable investing is on the rise. I'm Molly Wood for Marketplace.
You can hear more from Molly on the Marketplace special, How We Survive. You can hear it on select public media stations or at marketplace.org/climate. The pandemic has many of us spending our money in different ways this year. Another change that made many people reconsider how they spend is the ongoing racial justice movement. As Americans took to the streets to protest, there was also a push to support Black-owned businesses, with lists of local restaurants and other stores popping up across the country. We talked with Aaliyah Wanick back in September, who told us the spotlight on supporting Black-owned businesses meant her clothing line was booming. We checked back in with her to see how it's kept up.
I would say the past couple of months have been pretty crazy, I guess. I've released a few collections and they've done really well. They've kind of sold out within a couple days. It's pretty disorienting. It's just like I get frazzled a bit to see that level of support. And I'm not trying to say that in a way like I'm not grateful, but it's just this phenomenon that I just haven't experienced before, you know, to look and within 15 minutes, you're getting like 100 orders. I mean, that's insane. I think the big question that I've been trying to answer now is how do you increase production and try to meet the demand that's coming your way, but then you also don't want to like break your back and break your sewer's back. And it wasn't making sense in any way to triple our production and then still think that she and I could do that. So I have now transitioned to actually two factories locally. You may feel like you may want to invest more when you know it's me or one other person sewing. You know, it feels more personal. And then you say the word factory, and that feels like it's getting into some sort of mass production, or it just feels a bit distanced. But with the two factories that I've started to work with, I'm really focusing on my relationship with the owners and with the sewers and making that more personal. So for me, it doesn't feel like there's something that I'm losing, you know, in my value system or what I believe in my brand by working with them. I think it's just the nature of when you're growing, like you're scaling your business. There's just so much growth that has happened. I think the ability to handle this level of, you know, sustained ups and downs with production, with things getting delayed, with a third of my production getting lost. I've just had to say, like, 2020, it's been 2020. That's what 2020 has been doing this whole year, you know, and I've had to be resilient with that.
Aaliyah Wanick, clothing designer and speech therapist in Vallejo, California. Tell us your story at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final note on the way out, you know how Marielle was talking about that unprecedented level of online shopping, which means unprecedented levels of shipping. So spare a thought for your friendly neighborhood postal worker who has had quite a year. Remember, it was just a couple of months ago that the United States Postal Service, despite budget cuts and last-minute dismantling of sorting machines, processed more than 65 million mail-in ballots for the election. The agency is now promising extraordinary extraordinary measures for the Georgia Senate runoffs. And according to the Economic Policy Institute, the people carrying all of that mail are more likely to be Black and veteran than those working in the private sector. And for your Monday moment of economic context, one more thing on the Postal Service. USPS says on its website that it's experiencing unprecedented volume increases and limited employee availability due to the impacts of COVID-19. One of those impacts of COVID-19 is that about 19,000 postal workers are out sick with the virus or in quarantine due to exposure. So have a little patience with those late packages, friends. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kimberly Adams, and we'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.